on Hosea, the Heart and Holiness of God, entitled, Where Sin Abounded, Grace Did Much More Abound.
It should have been apparent, we hope, from our first study at the beginning of the week, when we looked at the blue sheet, especially in our series of notes, that the times in which Hosea lived were times of great apostasy. And another way of expressing it, in the language of Paul to the Romans, sin abounded. We recall from those two blue sheets, which have a composition of quotations from Amos and Hosea, commenting on the conditions of society at the time of the prophet's writing, that it was a period of wealth and ease for the noble classes, that it was also a time of oppression, a time of indifference to people's needs, especially the lower classes, that it was also a period of political turmoil and strife, marked especially by apostate forms of worship. Now, the title of our address today, Where Sin Hath Abounded, Grace Did Much More Abound, and yesterday's topic, where we were talking about Your Goodness Is as a Morning Cloud, both titles kind of mesh together and emphasize the fact that where sin has abounded, the Almighty is able still to work in a gracious way and bring His people back. No matter how deprived Israel was of goodness, no matter how transient, how unreliable their goodness was, like a cloud that appears for a time and then evaporates in the presence of the sun, no matter how uncertain and shaky their goodness was, God was still able and willing to work with them. Again, we think of the prodigal son. The father was still concerned, still peering down the road, hoping and waiting earnestly for the return of the apostate son. And that posture in the parable is God's posture, overlooking the whole scene in Hosea's time. Now, the theme of apostasy and judgment that we touched on yesterday, and the theme of sin abounding, is perhaps not a topic that appeals to us as much as other Bible topics. But to overlook this important theme in Hosea would really be a grave oversight. It is a very timely theme for Christadelphians in the 20th century as we come closer and closer to the return of Jesus Christ. The word apostasy needs a little defining. It is a word that we don't use in our common vernacular very often. It is a very biblical word. In fact, it's primarily a New Testament word. Being a Greek word, it occurs about 5 times in the New Testament. And the word apostasia in the Greek means literally to depart or to fall away from. And it stresses the idea of someone being on a certain course and deviating from it for some reason. That would be to literally apostatize from the original course. Of all the 5 references in the New Testament to apostasia, 2 of the most interesting for us, as far as they throw light on apostasy in the Old Testament, would be, first of all, the Apostle's reference in 2 Thessalonians 2 in the Man of Sin prophecy, in which, in verse 3 of 2 Thessalonians 2, he talks about a falling away that must occur first before Messiah can come. And that word, or that phrase, falling away, is one word in the Greek, apostasia. And it's literally translated in the AV in a way that describes the sense. The second occasion in the New Testament that is rather enlightening as far as what apostasia might mean is in Matthew 19 from the lips of the Lord himself. When speaking of Deuteronomy 24 and the bill of divorcement, The word for divorcement in Matthew 19 is the word apostasia. So what Jesus really said to his hearers in quoting Deuteronomy 24 is the fact that some may give a bill of apostasia, the literal translation for the English word divorcement. Now let's combine those two thoughts. In the New Testament, apostasia is associated in the man of sin prophecy with religious departure from truth, with religious falling away. In the Gospels, from the Lord himself, apostasy is also associated with marital unfaithfulness, a bill of divorcement, a bill of apostasia. Now combine those two thoughts and shows how much they relate to everything we're talking about in Hosea's prophecy and everything that is said about Israel's unfaithfulness during their times of weakness in the Old Testament. Religious apostasy and marital unfaithfulness are two of the major aspects in the Old Testament to describe Israel when they are sinful, when they are, quote, apostate. So the two New Testament references that deserve considerable attention relate very much to the Old Testament. Now in Jesus' day, the Old Testament we know was already translated from the Hebrew into the Greek language. That Bible was available to Greek readers at the time of Jesus. That was the Septuagint. Often the New Testament writers quote passages from the Old Testament using the Greek Bible, the Greek Septuagint. Now, for our purposes, what is particularly important, we turn now to Jeremiah 3, is that in the Greek Bible, in Jeremiah 3, the word apostasy, Greek word, is in fact used to describe Israel's unfaithfulness. We've already seen how the New Testament uses it to describe religious apostasy, and how it is used to describe a bill of divorcement, marital unfaithfulness. So it's highly appropriate to see this Old Testament background in Jeremiah chapter 3. And we read in verse 1, they say, if a man put away his wife, and she go from him and become another man's, shall he return unto her again? Shall not the land be greatly polluted? But thou hast played thee harlot with many lovers, yet return again unto me. And in that passage we have the Greek word apostasia being used to describe the harlot. And if we go down to verse 2, we have the word porneia, for whoredoms, in verse 2, to describe the kind of person that she is. Rich Old Testament background that throws a lot of light on what we're going to be reading about in Hosea. We go to verse 7 of the same chapter, and verses 8 and 9 are also useful. Verse 8 and verse 7. Let's look particularly here at the exhortation in verse 7 first. And I said, after she had done all these things, turn thou unto me. But she returned not. Now see the idea of going back to the right path from which she has apostatized or fallen away. Verse 8, and I saw when for all the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill, in the Greek Bible, a bill of apostasia, a bill of divorce. So when Jesus uses apostasia to describe divorcement in Matthew 19, there is a precedent, as it were, in the Greek Bible of the Old Testament, in the context of divorcement, and in the context of Israel's unfaithfulness as the bride of God. Now we go down in the same chapter and we can see further examples from the Septuagint, if we wish. Verse 9, it describes again the same state of unfaithfulness. Chapter 2, verse 19, describes the same kind of predicament that the woman is obviously in. For of all time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands, and thou hast said, I will not transgress, when upon every high hill and under every green tree thou wanderest playing the harlot. And the word transgress there in verse 20 represents the idea of apostasia in the original. So, we have this woman being described as unfaithful or apostate in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, it's related to her being an unfaithful bride. It's related to religious prostitution, her values, her beliefs. Her doctrines have changed and become those of the nations round about. She has apostatized. And therefore, those two concepts link tightly with the use of the same word in the New Testament. We're obviously meant to see the bridging of those two ideas. We go a little bit further with this as an introduction to some of the descriptions in Hosea. We find, for example, as we look at Hosea's prophecy, that as she is described as an unfaithful wife to God, an apostate, she is described in terms of Old Testament examples previous to the time of Hosea. And the examples are quite instructive, because the examples go right back to the beginning of Israel's history, when she first proved to adulterate or to pollute her religious doctrines and beliefs and mix them up with Gentile ideas, religious apostasy. And they go back to a time when she also, literally and figuratively, became an unfaithful bride to God. For example, if you go to Numbers chapter 25, we have what is probably one of the worst failures of Israel prior to their entrance into Canaan. And the circumstances are quite instructive. Here Israel, in Numbers 25, proves herself to be both a religious apostate and also an apostate as an unfaithful bride to God. She breaks her vows. Numbers 25, verse 1, Israel abides in Shittim. Verse 2, and they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods, referring to Moab at the end of verse 1. And the people, Israel, did eat and bow down to their gods. Notice the religious apostasy then. Verse 3, and Israel joined himself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And the Lord said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people, and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. Very severe measures. Verse 5. Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that were joined unto Baal Peor. Now notice the marital aspect here in this context. Verse 6. Behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses, and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping before the door. Verse 7. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand and went after the men of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the men of Israel and the woman, through the belly. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. The plague? Yes, there was a plague associated with God's anger upon the people. And the fact that he found them both in the tent is instructive as to what obviously was going on. Here they had bowed down to idols, in a figurative sense, apostatized, and literally, they were joining themselves to the pagans, and therefore the marital unfaithfulness as well. Lived out literally with this man and woman, and I guess he was typical of many of the others, and also figuratively, the bride of Israel had polluted herself, and Israel suffered. Now there, brothers and sisters, is a very severe historical precedent. It is no wonder, brothers and sisters, when we turn to Hosea chapter 9 and verse 10, that Baal Peor is mentioned to Israel in Hosea's appeal to his bride that is now apostate at Hosea's time. Marvelous to see the crossing over from the historical now to the figurative. Hosea chapter 9 and verse 10. The language like Ezekiel 16 that we stressed so much the other day comes into play here. Verse 10 of Hosea 9. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. Lovely picture. I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first time. Notice the word on that, the stress. I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first time. The stress on the initial condition of Israel as a fruitful, productive fig tree. Then, but they went to Baal Peor, Numbers 25, and separated themselves. We've mentioned that word. It's the word for the Nazarite. They consecrated themselves, or they became Nazarites dedicated to paganism and to apostasy. So, at Baal Peor, Israel proved herself to be a Nazarite dedicated to idolatry and apostate worship. So Hosea, through the Spirit's guidance, drags up this blemish in Israel's past. And it wasn't coincidentally taken from the context of the Old Testament. It was there in Baal Peor that both of the aspects of apostasy were incredibly joined together, acted out literally, and also seemed to be figuratively a symbol of unfaithfulness. So an awareness of Old Testament contexts, an awareness of what Brother John was saying the other day about the Nazarite, both come into play here in verse 10. An understanding of both concepts greatly enlarges our understanding of the exhortation. Now let's focus the lens on some other historical mentionings. We're not going to look all of these up in detail. In chapter 11, verse 8, the case of Sodom is mentioned in the context of the sin which abounded. In chapter 2, verse 15, Achor is mentioned as part of Israel's past failure. And we might say, Achor. Now, when did that occur? Well, if you recall, in the book of Joshua, it was the time when Achan took the Babylonian garment and the wedge of gold and hid them in his tent, contrary to the admonition of Joshua and the word of the Lord. And a plague broke out on Israel, and it wasn't stayed until Joshua interrogated the tribes and finally found Achan. And they stoned him there, and they left a great heap of stones. Because, says the record, Israel was troubled. And hence, Achor, troubling. In chapter 2, that incident also is brought to their minds. Now we've got Sodom. We've got the incident with Achan. We've got the incident at Baal Peor. Now we see a tie-in with Brother John Martin's study beautifully. John, we know, spent the other day emphasizing those last four chapters of Judges, broken into two stories. One of them surrounding Gibeah with the Levite's concubine, at which time, of course, the concubine was abused, divided its body to the parts of Israel, and Benjamin was then brought into focus with the other tribes and virtually annihilated. Now that occurred at Gibeah. That is mentioned twice in Hosea as another blemish from their past and as another warning against the abounding sin at the time of Hosea. Now where are those references? Hosea chapter 9, these we will look at. Lo and behold, it's right before Baal Peor. Hosea 9, verse 9, right beside the verse we just considered. And now, with all of John's background, I don't have to labor what Gibeah means. Verse 9. They, at the time of Hosea, have deeply corrupted themselves, as in the days of Gibeah. Therefore he will remember their iniquity, he will visit their sins. What a stain on the conscience of Israel. A time of atrocities on a scale never seen before when a woman was abused that way. A Levite's concubine at that, parted into 12 pieces in a rather barbaric way, and where a tribe of Israel was virtually annihilated at the cruelty and the overreaction of the neighboring tribes. Gibeah, though, is mentioned again, if they hadn't got the point, in chapter 10. And again, all of John's background helps so much. Chapter 10, verse 9. Consider the pathos, the emotion in the prophet's voice. O Israel, thou hast sinned from the days of Gibeah. There they stood, the battle in Gibeah, against the children of iniquity. In other words, the people of the city of Gibeah and the Benjaminites. Against the children of iniquity did not overtake them. It is in my desire that I should chastise them, and the people shall be gathered against them, when they shall bind themselves in their two furrows. The historical incidents in Israel's past, being dredged up, as it were, by the prophet, to remind them of two things: the grossness of their apostasy at the present, the fact that it was related to the grossness of their apostasy in the past, the fact that in every one of those cases, the nation suffered at the hands of God as a result of their unfaithfulness. Now, what's the bottom line for Israel then at the time of Hosea? If you were apostate like that in the past, and I judged you, what's God now going to do, northern ten tribes, if you're acting like the sins of Sodom? If you're behaving like you did at Baal Peor? If you're acting like Achan did? If you're behaving like the incidents at Gibeah? Then what's going to happen to you, O Israel? And of course, it was inevitable. Within a matter of years, the Assyrians came down and did to the ten tribes what God did in each of those scenes in their past failures. The great importance then is stressed for us, brothers and sisters, of being aware of Old Testament links and understanding the context of those links as they throw light on our understanding of a prophet like Hosea. Further, along the theme of the sins which abounded in the nation, chapter 8, verse 1 has a rather beautiful echo to a contemporary prophet, which we mentioned when we looked at the background of the prophet at the very beginning on the first day. We mentioned that Isaiah was a contemporary. Now notice the parallel here in chapter 8, verse 1, with the prophetic warning in Isaiah. Set the shofar, verse 1 of chapter 8, set the shofar to thy mouth. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, Deuteronomy 28. Because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law, Israel shall cry unto me, my God, we know thee. Israel hath cast off the thing that is good, the enemy shall pursue him. Now notice the prophet's posture here. Set the shofar to thy mouth. Hold your hand there and go over to Isaiah and see what Isaiah is saying at the same time, or at least within the same period. Isaiah chapter 58, verse 1. And the context in Isaiah is instructive. We haven't time to look at all of it. Isaiah 58 and Isaiah 59 seem to be in the context of the Day of Atonement. There's a lot of terms used in those two chapters that relate to the language of the Day of Atonement. Significantly, in verse 1 of Isaiah 58, cry aloud, says Isaiah, spare not, lift up thy voice like a shofar, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. Now, where is the historical association of a prophet speaking on God's behalf and his voice being likened to a shofar? Exodus 19. The first occasion where God's voice is associated with the sound of the shofar and the background to all that the law says about how the shofar shall be used to draw the people and God's attention on the holy days. We go back then to Exodus chapter 19. And a quick look at the original would show us that the shofar is used here. Now this is Sinai, and the context is quite significant in terms of Hosea and Isaiah 58. Exodus 19, and we look at verse 13 first. There shall not an hand touch it, that's the mount, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through, whether it be beast or man, it shall not live. When the trumpet, now that's the word yobel, translated jubilee elsewhere in the law. When the yobel, or the jubilee, soundeth long, they shall come up to the mount, draw near. Verse 16, and it came to pass on the third day, and that's significant, in the morning, and that's quite important, that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, a typical God manifestation scene, and the voice of the shofar, exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled. Verse 19, when the voice of the shofar sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake and God answered. Now, notice verse 10. And the Lord said unto Moses, go unto the people and sanctify them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes. The background to Isaiah 58, the background to Hosea chapter 8, verse 1. Hosea, Isaiah, lift up your voice, and let it be sounded like the shofar at Sinai, where the people were told to wash their clothes. Where the people were told that if they want to come into a covenant relationship with me and ratify the covenant at Sinai, they must wash their clothes. And God's voice and presence was magnified by the sound of the shofar. The deep historical background for all that is said in reference to the shofar then elsewhere in the law. Particularly at Sinai, it's significant for us in studying Hosea. Because we noticed in Ezekiel 16 that Sinai was the place where the marriage contract between God and Israel was ratified. Here, brothers and sisters, in Exodus 19 is the marriage between God and Israel. Here is the marriage contract being agreed upon by both parties. Here is God and Israel taking their vows. And God says, before you take your vows, Israel, wash your clothes. How highly symbolic of what was outwardly meant to be applied inwardly. So show their people their transgressions, Isaiah. Show them that they have dirty laundry. Hosea chapter 8, set the shofar to thy mouth. Warn the people of their sins and tell them they've soiled their garments. They have dirty laundry in Israel. And that unless they clean it and scrub it and attend themselves like they did at Sinai, that marriage contract that was ratified at Sinai will be vitiated. It'll be destroyed. So the play on the context of the marriage contract in Exodus 19 goes way back from that one word, the trumpet. And of course we see the significance of the fact that Hosea, as well as Isaiah, were both sounding the shofar through their prophetic call. Were both telling the people to wash their clothes. How highly descriptive, brothers and sisters, of the dirtiness and the apostasy that had infiltrated every aspect of Hosea's society. How sad it was. Further, the language is even more graphic. If we go down now to Hosea chapter 8, verse 4, it says, I knew it not. They have set up kings, says God, but not by me. They have made princes, and I, God, knew it not. God is saying in Hosea 8, verse 4, that he ignores what they are doing. Now, verse 9, they are gone up to Assyria. A wild ass alone by himself. There's Israel. Ephraim hath hired lovers. Look at how degrading God pictures Israel. A wandering, stubborn ass wandering through the desert, having no master, under no rein, subject to no one, directionless, having no purpose, of no domestic value to man or God. That's Israel. Useless. Verse 14. For Israel hath forgotten his maker. Now, if that's not graphic enough, a look at the original makes it even more graphic. Because the word forgotten in the original, the Hebrew word shakah, means literally to mislay. And some of the modern translations appropriately translate the first part of verse 14, for Israel hath mislaid his maker. Now, what a contrast to Israel's posture here, having mislaid their God, not knowing exactly where he is in the room, and what we find in Jesus' words in the parables of the lost coin and the pearl of great price. The woman with the lost coin. She searched the house and made sure she found it. The opposite of having mislaid it, the beginning process. The pearl of great price, the man stumbles across it, as it were, in the field, and picks it up and appreciates the pristine beauty of what he has found, the truth in Christ, the good news, the man responsive to God's call. Both of those parables talk about finding God. And here is Israel, somehow, they don't know where, God has slipped beyond their grasp, past their sight. They don't exactly know where God is, fumbling around in the darkness. And God is just mislaid. They've been preoccupied so much with themselves and with apostasy that God has been mislaid. How could that possibly be? But it happened. Hosea chapter 4, verse 12, zeroes in a little bit more on some of the idolatrous descriptions of Israel. We won't labor these details. They're perhaps more familiar than some of the other descriptions. But there is exhortational value to us. Hosea 4, verse 12. Notice how gross their worship was. My people ask counsel at their stocks. Not asking God, but at the wooden stocks. And their staff declareth unto them, for the spirit of whoredoms hath caused them to err, and they have gone a-whoring from under their God. Now those words are important. Here's the idolatrous scene. They are going to wooden stocks, standing in front of some kind of a wooden pillar and saying, what do you think I should do tomorrow? Should I do this or should I do that? Asking a wooden piece questions and expecting answers and directions. More than that, she's described in verse 12 as an unfaithful woman. And then she's described as having gone from under their God. Now, we haven't got time, but there's a word link there. If you go back to Numbers chapter 5, verse 19, and look at your margin, it's in the context of the trial of jealousy, where a woman is accused by her husband of being unfaithful. She is brought before the judges. She is told to drink certain type of water, which is bitter, and if it swells her thighs and her stomach enlarges, then she's proven to be guilty, and the husband's suspicion is valid. Now, in the context of Numbers 5, in the law of jealousy, the same Hebrew phrase occurs as it does here in verse 12, and the margin of the AV puts you onto it. From under their God is used three times as a Hebrew idiom or expression in Numbers 5 to describe the woman accused of jealousy in terms of what she should be in relation to her husband. She should be under her husband. As they, Israel, in Hosea 4, should be subject as a wife to their God, their husband. So the link with the law of jealousy, the woman accused of unfaithfulness, is being brought to bear here in the context of their apostasy. And God is running a trial, as it were. Israel, the unfaithful woman, is suspected of infidelity. And God is cross-examining her through the words of the prophet. And he's looking to see whether there's any good cause to be jealous for her. And he's really threatening her, as Numbers 5 would, that if she is proven to be whorish, unfaithful to her husband, then she will corrupt herself, her thighs, figuratively speaking, will rot, and she will suffer death. And that's exactly what God is saying here in accusing her directly of being an idolatrous woman and consulting the stocks. Again, the Old Testament background. How important it is for us to realize in the 20th century that although we may not consult wooden stocks, we may consult the television, we may consult the radio for advice, we may consult the psychologists and the psychiatrists and the physicians of this age who can do very little than cure the surface of our troubles. They cannot and they will never be able to penetrate to the depths that is needed to remedy our faults, our weaknesses, and our sin. It is only the great physician that can heal us. So though we may not consult stocks that are wooden, we may consult man, and we may consult something other than God that is really in composition, or rather in opposition, to God's ways. To whom do we go for advice when we are in trouble? Who do we consult when we need advice? To the Word, to our brothers and sisters who are influenced by that Word, or to outside family members who give us perhaps a ready shoulder. Perhaps it's comforting, but does it provide the kind of enduring assistance that we need? Let's go back to Hosea 9 and look at some of the other figures used to describe distorted vision and blindness in the nation. Hosea 7, verse 3. They make the king glad. That's the people, right? With their wickedness, and the princes with their lies. They are all adulterers, as an oven heated by the baker, who ceaseth from raising after he hath kneaded the dough until it be leavened. In the day of our king, the princes have made him sick with bottles of wine. He stretched out his hand with scorners. Now notice what's happening. The rulers of the land are being intoxicated by the people. They are accepting bribes and persuasion. Their judgment is distorted and perverted. They are accepting influence from the people when they're supposed to be giving the people direction. They are likened to this baking process and the figure of the oven and the rising dough and the firing of the dough is picked up in verse 4 and returned to in verse 6. For they have made ready their heart like an oven. Whilst they lie in wait, the baker sleepeth all the night. In the morning it burneth as a flaming fire. They are all hot as an oven, and have devoured their judges. All their kings are fallen, there is none among them that calleth upon me. Now we consider that figure, it's hard to sort out in the King James, but it is alluding to a common practice in the process of bread making. There was the oven. Customarily, it was stoked the night before, and it was allowed to heat during the night while the baker slept. The coals then in the morning would be well settled, and the brickwork would be well penetrated with heat. Of course, during the same time, while the oven was being prepared during the night, the dough was also left to rise. So the oven is stoked, and they're likened in verse 3, 5, and 6 to the people themselves that are like an open oven, hot and flaming, ready to devour their own rulers, and they bribe their rulers and intoxicate them by their false influence. Meanwhile, verse 4, the bread rises. Notice it's during the night. The people bide their time. The leavening of the bread obviously denotes the ripening of the circumstances for the committing of the crime. They bide their time. They wait for the right moment. Finally, in verse 7, the bread is thrown in. Who's the bread? Or what is the bread? The kings are murdered. That goes back to 2 Kings 15. One after the other is usurped. One man slays his brother. Like a great mouthed oven, the rulers are thrown into the people and they destroy them like a consuming oven. Finally, the bread is baked beyond the proper time. Verse 8. Ephraim, he hath mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. What a figure, brothers and sisters, to describe an apostate people. We would say burnt toast. Here the figure is obviously showing that the bread has sat on the oven all night long, and one side of the bread is charred, and it's hard, it's impenetrable. And God says, Ephraim, you're like a burnt piece of toast. You're hard, not edible, something that is repugnant to the eater, and you are impenetrable. I cannot get through to you. You are stubborn. I have pleaded with you through Hosea. I have pleaded with you through Amos. I have sent my prophets rising up early, and you will not respond to me. You're like an oven ready to consume your own rulers. And you're like a hard-baked piece of bread that has not been turned and has sat on the oven all night. Phrase after phrase, example after example, to illustrate their apostasy. Sin has abounded. Notice their insensitivity. And notice their blindness is stressed in the same chapter. Notice we go down now to verse 9. Strangers have devoured his strength, and he knoweth it not. Is that natural? We notice when we have a mosquito draining a small tenth of an ounce from our arm. We notice the fly buzzing in our ear, and we brush it aside. We can hear that coming from a distance when we're lying down. Especially true at kids' camp. We all know that. We can notice when anybody or anything is about to bother us and sap our strength. Even the smallest insect is brought to our attention very, very easily. But with Israel, strangers have devoured his strength, and he doesn't know it. Second figure. Yea, gray hairs are here and there upon him, yet he knoweth it not. Is that natural? How many of us are aware once we pass our 20s? We notice, brethren, as we look to do our shaving in the morning, here and there a white hair appears. Sisters perhaps notice it a little sooner. Perhaps the touch-up is desired. But of course, the vigilant watching for those white hairs is an ongoing vigilance for many people. The brother, if he hasn't noticed it, certainly by the time he gets down to breakfast, has perhaps a kind arm placed over his shoulder, and the wife says, "You have a gray hair there, dear." "I can see it. I've been told that more than once. You see that hair by your ear? Can I just pull it out?" It's natural. We notice the gray hairs. We notice them more than we notice a lot of other things in the house. Israel has gray hairs speckled all over them, and they don't know it. And the gray hairs, obviously, are indicative of their sins. One sin after another until there's a liberal sprinkling, and they don't know it. Further in verse 11, Ephraim is like a silly dove without heart. Like a dove with no place to rest. Silly, unpredictable, flighty, passing from one branch to another, hopping from here to there. Not only that, we go down to verse 16 for our conclusion. They return, but not to the Most High. They are like a deceitful bow. Their princes shall fall by the sword. The last figure, used to describe the apostasy of Israel in their stubbornness and their unfaithfulness. Brothers and sisters, we can't help but read those passages and realize that if they were insensitive to sin, if they were desensitized from sin's sting, if they had their heart like a burnt piece of dough, how easy is it for us to have distorted vision, to be blind to the hairs on our own figurative body? How easy it is for us to be idolatrous and not know it. How easy it is for us, brothers and sisters, to allow sin to abound and to receive, not at all, His gracious bounty of forgiveness and call.